offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind, and we are coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. As part of this Afternoon Satsang series, we go through the conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. On the Afternoon Satsang, we have gone through many themes. We usually take up themes based on Swami's message. We have taken up books written by Swami. But this series in which we go through these conversations, it is almost like if we were to be a part of an interview in which we were blessed to have the opportunity to sit in front of Swami, ask him questions, or be an observer to conversations that was happening. The lovely exchanges that could happen there, the clarifications that one could receive, it is like being a witness to all of that. And after so many years, and as we are going through this, we can make out that most of these conversations happened in the 70s. So a very good more than 50 years later to be sitting and reading them and feeling it as fresh as it was then. I think that's the beauty of whatever is related to Swami, whatever is associated with Swami. I think that's the pleasure we are having of going through these conversations, varied concepts, varied themes. And today's too is not going to be any different from that. We had some interesting insights last week when we were going through where the discussion kind of turned towards the epics like Ramayana and Mahabharata, where his lapas, whether they are historical accounts or they are profound stories with deep inner meaning. And Swami said, yes, they do have inner meaning, very deep inner meaning, and they have to be looked at that way. But nevertheless, they are historical accounts. They are stories of men and women who have walked this very land of Bharat. And I think that's what we were going through. And Swami also started speaking about the advancements that they had. And Swami said the Pushpaka Vimana was the first flight, so to say, that was used in those days. I think that was the point where we left off. The conversation is going to continue from there. But before we go into what Swami is going to speak to Hislop and the other visitors there, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem and Sairam to all our listeners. Last week, when Hislop asked Swami whether the people in the times of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, whether they used atomic energy for power, Swami began to dilate on the power of the mantra. Swami explains that there is tantra, there is yantra, and there is mantra. Of course, not in this conversation, but many times in his discourses, Swami has explained that things can be achieved through tantra, mantra, and yantra. And last week, I think we concluded with this aspect where we discussed how tantra is the technique, yantra is the instrument, while mantra is the affirmation and power and vibrational energy, more akin to self-confidence, that helps us to achieve anything. I think also last week we discussed that amazing experience of Dr. Vijay Kumar during the 1985 interview, wherein the people in the interview room got a glimpse of the power of the Gayatri Mantra, because Swami revealed that even if there was one person on board the Air India Kanishka flight, which was downed by a terrorist attack in 1985, Swami said that the fate would have been different had even one person on flight chanted the Gayatri Mantra. So that came in because Swami tells Hislop that even Westerners who experiment with the Gayatri Mantra find that it has power. The mantra should be said by a person well practiced in spiritual life. And for that, I think we have got ample examples, many of them which we have had the pleasure and privilege of documenting as part of the, I think it was the Good Morning with Gayatri series on the YouTube channel, where Brother Bishu interviewed many such people who have been sincerely practicing the chanting of Gayatri Mantra, along with the phenomenally wonderful experiences they have had because of that. Well, I would like to request all our listeners to definitely go to YouTube, go to the Radio Sai channel and look up for these videos, Good Morning with Gayatri videos, so that you get an insight and a peep into the potential that is there in the Gayatri Mantra. With that, we can also understand the potential that exists in all the other mantras. Every mantra is there for a reason. And Swami is emphasizing that here because I think in modern times, Prem, that we have got so obsessed with technique and instrumentation that the mantra doesn't get its due. We are always behind the yantra and tantra. And in places where we see yantra and tantra missing, we just assume that nothing can be done. And it's all because we have totally ignored and forgotten the power of the mantra.
If you really look at science and the way science looks at experimentation and looks at instrumentation, you know, it always looks to remove the person from the picture. You know, it should not depend on who I am. It should not depend on the skills of the person who's conducting the experiment, or at least if a certain set pattern is followed, whether you're a scientist in Russia, whether you're a scientist in India, you should get the same results. You know, they call that repeatability.
Replicability.
Huh? Replicability of the experiment and such things. So it's typically you're removing the importance of the person. The objective approach is looked at. You know, the subject is removed out of the equation, so to say. But if you really look at how a mantra works, Swami would often say that, you know, it all depends on the purity of the person who is chanting, the faith with which it is being chanted, or the intention with which it is being chanted, the bhava. And I think science always has a problem when you say that it depends on the person who is doing it, or it depends on the nature or the thinking of the person who is doing it, because these are all, you know, immeasurables. You cannot document these, you cannot replicate some of these. But the fact is, spirituality is always the other way around. It is not about what the other world does, other world thinks. Sometime back, you know, we had shared this beautiful clip where Swami is talking to students in Kodaikanal. Maybe a year back, it was part of the the Thursday Darshan that we had posted, where in that one of the students asked this question. He said, Swami, you know, so the avatar is here and we're all spending so much time here. But what about those so many people who do not even know that God is there in a human form? And Swami's answer was, you know, what would you think that Swami's answer would be? Probably Swami would say, you should inform them, or, you know, they will eventually come. And Swami's answer was a little different. Swami said, why should you bother about that? Swami says, when God comes down in a human form, your equation with him is 1-to-1. In that equation, nobody else features. It's not about, Swami, you have come and I am the only one in 7 billion who know you are here. Or, you know, only 1,000 of us know that you are here. Swami says, it doesn't matter. When God comes down, it is for you. It is about, are you making use of that opportunity? So in spirituality, it's all about the individual. It's all about what that individual does. And there is nothing which is small or big for Swami. You know, we've seen that Swami would do enormous things just so that one person understands or one person grows. So I think that is the difference between spirituality and science itself, and that reflects in the way we look at or embrace this concept of a mantra itself.
See, when you say that it should be replicable and everybody should be able to do it irrespective of who it is, when you go in with that kind of a mindset, that is when you look at some episodes and incidents that happen as miraculous and, in quotes, unscientific. I would like to say that based on what Swami has said, the so-called scientific approach is unscientific, because you are removing out of the equation a very, very important participant, which is the person. By saying that it's objective and so we should remove the subject, you may decide to remove the subject, but the importance of the subject doesn't cease simply because you have decided not to give importance to the subject. It's akin to saying that I don't believe in gravity and therefore if I step off the building, I should not come crashing to the ground. Whether I believe or not, it works. So also, whether I consider the subject or not, there is the influence of the subject. You know, my mind travels back to the 2nd of December 1984, when one of the worst tragedies in possibly world history, or definitely in Indian history, struck at Bhopal in Madhya Pradesh. The city of Bhopal, there was a union carbide plant from which the methyl isocyanate gas leaked. It is very infamous today as the Bhopal gas tragedy. And people who were sleeping in the night, they were unaware that they were breathing in poisonous fumes, and hundreds of thousands of them died over the next few years, and another hundreds of thousands of them got affected because this went and caused damage at the DNA level. And so generations ahead, though they didn't inhale those poisonous fumes, they were affected. one of the greatest humanitarian disasters, man-made disasters, because of negligence or, well, we are not going into the causes of that. But what was interesting is, in the January of 1985, there was an article in one of India's leading newspapers which brought out some of the most phenomenal survival stories of a certain families. So these families were all from the direct, if I can call it, blast radius. I mean, this is the area where people have just been wiped out clean, died. They didn't even wake up to see the morning. They just died in their sleep. So they happened to be in that zone, but they have woken up in the early hours of the morning to continue with what they have been doing from many years, Vedic rituals and Vedic practices, chanting of mantras. Some of the families happen to be Agnihotri families, who, Agnihotri meaning they are associated with the fire or Agni. So every morning they begin with a kind of a mini yagna. They light the fire at home and offer oblations to it, and they chant and do different things. So they found that all these people didn't get affected, didn't even have to go to the doctor. They didn't even show any kind of symptom. Absolutely fit and fine. And the only thing common in all of them, apart from the fact that they were all in that blast radius, was the fact that they were practicing some kind of a Vedic ritual, either a fire ceremony, chanting, using of mantras, all these things. And as always, the scientific world scoffed at these people. They came up with, you know, different kinds of explanations. Somebody said that, you know, when you do the mantra, when you do the yagna, depending on the kind of wood that have been used, these kind of particulate matter get emitted and cover the environment inside the house. And because of that, that has ability to absorb chemical radiations, and therefore it protected the family. So all such explanations came up, but definitely, you know, it brought about a greater awareness about Vedic rituals in India, because Indians are traditionally people who believe firmly in the existence of God, in the power of God, and this was nothing more than an affirmation of that power of God. You know, it reminds me of how the people in Puttaparthi in the early days, when Swami began to exhibit the miraculous powers that he has, they said that it is not that Swami is an avatar, it is because the scorpion that stung him had a golden tipped sting, and anybody that scorpion stings will become a divine personality, an avatar, like, you know, like this Sai Baba. So people are ready to believe in a story that is about a golden tipped sting of a scorpion, but they're not ready to accept that a person is the avatar. In the same way, science at that time came up with so many explanations. Again, this is one thing that I find discriminatory in the approach of science, possibly. While they come up with all those explanations, it has never been tested after that. I mean, you never subjected somebody else to methyl isocyanate and you know, light up fires with the smoke all around. Try, come on, try it. Nobody has the guts to try it out, but they have the cheek to say that this is the reason, and it's nothing to do with the Gayatri mantra chanting or the chanting of any mantras. So, looks like the disbelievers will remain disbelievers, but for those who are ready to try and believe, I think everybody will be able to see the magic that these mantras and these chants provide. And that's why I was urging all our listeners that please do listen to the Good Morning with Gayatri series, wherein with this particular mantra, there are different people who have shared what they have experienced, and what they have experienced is quite powerful.
And, you know, talking about this kind of disaster, of course, I recall two other incidents where the devotees chanting mantras and how they were protected. One of that is, I think, during the tsunami which happened in southern India, 2004, right?
2006.
I think one of the most profound sevas that was done by Swami's devotees, especially Sai youth, were going and clearing corpses off the beach in that time. You know, the sea had come well into the city, and then it had, you know, pulled out so many people. And later in the day and the next day, all these corpses were washing onto the beach. And that created a very, very dangerous situation of decomposing bodies, right? You know,
the infection.
Infection, epidemics breaking out. So somebody had to clear out. I mean, there were, the whole city had risen up in doing seva. Not only Swami's devotees, people were serving food and people were accommodating others and all of that. But this is something which nobody was coming forward to do. You have to go and, you know, clear these half-decomposing bodies over there. And apparently the Sai organization was approached. They saw that these youth were getting themselves involved in all kinds of activities. They're helping all the people. They said, can you come and help us in this? And the organization readily agreed and they went. And all of them, I think later we also had the opportunity to speak to a couple of boys who were part of that seva. They said constantly they were only chanting Sai Gayatri and Gayatri Mantra, and not one of them even had a, you know, a small fever or a small infection or anything like that. And that is one thing which is reminded of. And the other one is the other tsunami which happened probably right across the globe in Japan when the Fukushima disaster happened. Again, we happened to speak to one of our seniors, Sonu Ram Shankar. I think that interview also is there as part of FMLM. He was in Japan at that time. He was doing his postdoctoral work there. And when the, you know, this disaster happened, it was one of, tsunami always comes with a disaster, and this was near a nuclear plant. So even the people who were going to rescue, I mean, perform rescue operations, they were very scared because they had the threat of radiation causing injuries and causing problems there. So again, it was the Sai youth who went there. And Sonu Ram Shankar was telling that, you know, he being a Swami student, one they all looked up to, and he was also their Veda teacher and all of that. And he said, we don't have to worry at all. Swami is with us. And he told, we'll just keep chanting the Trayambakam Mantram. And we'll go there. Swami has said that Trayambakam Mantram is like a shield. Nothing will come past it. And he said, we all went there. We did seva. We came back. Not one of us fell sick. And even the local authorities were really scared to let them go and, you know, work in those places. He said, we are not worried about anything. And of course, added beautiful angle to that was all this was happening in the April of 2011. So he was saying in the middle of all this, they also get the news that, you know, Swami is hospitalized and Swami is, you know, all these kind of things are happening. And he said, see, for us, it became like, you know, what was the rest of the world doing when they got to know the news? They were praying. And for us, this was a part of the prayer that, you know, as we pray to Swami to heal himself, we were also doing what Swami would expect us to do. And, you know, any number of stories, I'm sure that this is not the end of it. But the fact that Swami is saying here, and as Swami was saying here, it also depends on the spiritual progress or the spiritual state of the person who is chanting the mantra. I think that's where the, as we were saying, problem comes, because it becomes subjective. But that's the nature of any mantra. Like Swami was saying, there are many times in the portico, Swami would cure a person. This is a scene which a lot of people have seen. Somebody would go inside the interview room in a wheelchair but come back walking. There are people who have gone inside the interview room on a stretcher and come out walking. And Swami would come and Swami would then explain, you know, what is the problem with that person and how that person was cured. And at the end of it, Swami will see the students and say, see, how did it happen? So they said, Swami, you're divine, you would have done it. Swami said, no, it's because of their faith. And Swami said, because they had the faith, that cure could happen. And so that is a very important thing, be it mantra, be it miracles, be it any change. In fact, there's another discussion which is going to come in the conversation we're going to go through, where Swami says that belief, that faith means so much.
Just going ahead, Hislop then tells Swami, Swami does not seem to give out mantras. When his devotees are ready for mantra, should they ask Swami or will he say when they are ready? And Swami replies, mantras now are given out by low persons, the head of a mutt here and there, some yogi and so on. Avatars have never given mantras. The avatar shows that God is everywhere. The recitation of a mantra is narrow-minded. In the time of an avatar, to hear him, to understand what he says and do it, is in itself a mantra. Krishna gave no mantra to the Pandava brothers, not even to Arjuna. He simply said, do this, do that. That was enough, and the action was very powerful. Now, these words from Swami are so amazing, because even chanting of the mantra, you know, can get monotonous, can get boring, and it may not be possible for us to remember that we have to chant mantra always. Here and in the conversation that we shall see as we go ahead, Swami makes it very clear that if you have love for Swami and are ready to do what he has said, told you to do, that's enough. It's more powerful than a mantra. It'll take care of everything. And Swami says that Krishna never gave a mantra. In fact, that story, that episode wherein Krishna promises a mantra to the Pandavas in order to help them overcome all their difficulties has been dramatized many times in Swami's presence as part of multiple dramas. Swami has narrated that story many times, wherein finally the mantra that Krishna writes for Yudhishthira and tells him to look at it in the time of their greatest difficulty is a statement which says, "This too shall pass." And so it's more like a guiding principle that the avatar gives as a mantra, because it is as powerful as a mantra if you're able to follow that guiding principle. And here Swami is saying, just follow what Swami has said. Just follow. Don't ask why, don't ask how. Just do it. And that kind of implicit obedience is enough. It'll be more powerful than a mantra. It also reminds me of that very famous story, Professor Kasturi in Banaras, the holy city of Kashi. When they're there, it is believed that Kashi is one of the epicenters for Hinduism, and that is a place where every Hindu tries to travel once at least in his or her lifetime. And Professor Kasturi felt it would be wonderful if he is given the mantra by his guru, his Sadguru, which is Swami, in Kashi. And he had requested Swami, and Swami had said, yes, I will give it. But it was quite some time, and it became apparent that Swami is not giving this mantra to Professor Kasturi. Professor Kasturi was very morose at the dining table, and Swami asked him, why are you so morose? And he says, Swami, you had promised me a mantra, you are not giving me the mantra. So now Swami gets up, goes near Professor Kasturi and asks him, Kasturi, you don't feel so bad. Why is it that you want a mantra? He says, Swami, why else does anybody want a mantra? They want a mantra to go closer to God. Then Swami gently bends down to Kasturi's level, his hair brushing against Kasturi's face, and whispers in his ear, how much closer, Kasturi? You know, through this incident, Swami shows so clearly that even without us asking, he has conferred on us some of the greatest boons. All we need to do is have patience, have perseverance, have faith, hold on and do what he says. That's enough. Because as Swami says here, an avatar never gives the mantra. An avatar only tells what has to be done. Whatever he says is the Vedavakya. Whatever he says is the Satya. Whatever he does is Dharma. It's only the other gurus who give mantras like this. You don't need a mantra.
Right, and really what Swami says is so profound. You know, he says to hear him, to understand him, and to do what he says, there cannot be a greater mantra. In fact, just going back to that, this too shall pass. Swami has also done this a couple of times, you know, even in public discourses, where he would say that I'm going to give you a mantra. And two such occasions. One is when he said that I'm going to give you a mantra, and he said the mantra is, I'm not an animal, I'm man. Swami said, that is the mantra. Keep reciting it and your life will become better. And another time is one Guru Purnima time, I think recently you played that discourse also sometime, where Swami says, I'm going to give you a Panchakshari today. Panchakshari is a five-syllable mantra. Usually, I think Om Namah Shivaya is a Panchakshari.
It's a Panchakshari.
Right?
Om Namah Shivaya.
Yeah, so Swami would say, I'm going
Namah Shivaya, sorry. Namah Shivaya is the Panchakshari.
Right. So Swami would say, I'm going to give you a Panchakshari mantra. And at the end of it, Swami said, the mantra is Devudunnadu. Said, Swami said, see, five alphabets. Devudunnadu. He said,
God
and
exists.
He said, God exists. And then Swami went on to say, you know, Swami did not make a mockery of it or something like that. I mean, Swami doesn't do that with anything. But Swami explained why these are mantras. And Swami said, see, what is a mantra? Mananatrayate iti mantra. That which you keep contemplating on helps you get through this. Right?
Protects you. It protects the one who...
Right. And it makes you, it helps you in this journey to cross over. Right? That's what it is. So Swami says, in this journey of life, you need something to keep your focus. You need something to ensure that you don't do anything wrong. And you're progressing in the right direction. And Swami said, can there be a better mantra than this? To constantly believe that there is God. You know, when you do good and good does not come back to you, to believe that there is God. When somebody is being unfair to you, to believe that there is God. So Swami was saying that, can there be a better mantra than this? And the avatar comes for that. To reinstate the faith that there is God, and whatever you're doing can be offered to him and it gets noted, right? That was that occasion. And the other one, of course, I said is when Swami said, you're not an animal, you're a man. So Swami said that will help you reason that I cannot think like an animal. I cannot react like an animal. I have to choose like a man. I have to live like a man. And that was one occasion. And the third occasion which I remember is, I think, when Swami was speaking to the Balvikas gurus. What Swami was saying here, you know, it has just come from a discussion where Swami spoke about the Gayatri Mantra. And Swami has spoken extensively about the Pranava Mantra. Swami has spoken about the Vedas themselves as mantras, as I said, Trayambakam Mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. Swami has that, you know, Shivratri when Swami
made everybody chant
Om Namah Shivaya.
Sahana Bhavatu, right. He has explained.
So, and when Swami is saying, say, these are mantras that do not come with a validity period, and they don't come with an expiry date. What Gayatri Mantra could do 10,000 years ago can do it even now. So you really don't need to go out scouting for mantras. These are all mantras that are potent, that even today if you take them and chant them, you will benefit out of it. And in that context, Swami was saying a very beautiful play of words also. And Swami said, see, if you're a person who believes that you are the body, like the people who have strong dehabhimanam, but they're spiritual people, they're good people, they're a sadhaka, they want to progress in the spiritual path. Swami said the mantram for them is dasoham. He said, you constantly tell yourself, I am a, you know, the servant of the Lord. I am a servitor. Whatever you do, do it as a service to the Lord. And then Swami said, there are people who are a little more advanced. They think they are not the body, but they are the jivatma. That they are this personality which has been traveling from one body to the other, being a man, being a woman, being rich, being poor and all of that. So for those people who believe that they are the jivatma, Swami said, from dasoham, their mantra becomes soham. That I am he. I and he are one. Swami said, then went on to say that, see, even there is duality, because you're saying he and me. For that person who is in the stage where they're able to assert that I am the Atma, Swami said, Saha, which means he, and Aham, which means me, both can be removed. And Om becomes the mantra. So Swami said, Dasoham, Soham and Om. What more mantra do you need? Everything is there in that itself. So in that sense, when Swami says that the Lord does not have to give a mantra, it is so deep in so many senses. And most often, you know, most of the devotees who have themselves very humbly confessed later, when they said that they wanted a mantra from Swami, it's almost like a sign of exclusivity or entitlement. Swami gave me a mantra and I'm able to chant it or whatever it is. And there is that very beautiful conversation between Shirdi Baba and a lady who was obsessed about getting a mantra from Baba. She comes and she fasts for many days and all of that. And then Shirdi Baba refuses to give a mantra. She goes hungry for almost 3 days or a week or something, and people come and tell Baba that
she's going to die
and the name is going to come to you. Do something. Why can't you just give her a mantra? So then Shirdi Baba says, okay, call her, and then asks that lady, why do you want a mantra from me? Why have you come here? So she said, I want to take you as my guru. And Shirdi Baba asked, what is so special about getting a mantra from a guru? Why can't you get it from anybody? So she said, Baba, Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, the Vedas say, Guru is the Lord himself. And that is why I have accepted you as my guru and I want a mantra from you. And then Shirdi Baba says, you tell me that Guru is Brahma, Guru is Vishnu and Guru is Maheshwara. Is the guru's name not good enough for you? He says, if you really believe that I am the Trinity and you have come to me worshipping me, why can't you chant my name? The very fact that you think that something has to be given exclusively to you, he said, it's an expression of an ego. Don't give place to that. He said, take care of your body because it is gifted to you for this spiritual journey. Take my name, take any name of the Lord, keep it constantly in your mind and you will be saved.
See, this pursuit for a mantra and clouding it with a lot of secrecy, not sharing. Definitely, if that is what the guru or Swami prescribes in some cases.
Definitely. I think some people might probably be given that.
But this general need, as you say, arises as an extension of our own egoistic need for exclusivity. I remember one of our brothers narrating how when he got the opportunity to stay with Swami, he once asked Swami, he said, Swami, tell me something that you have never told anybody. See, again, that need for exclusivity. And he said that Swami told some things, some spiritual concepts explained. I'm not able to recollect those details now. But Swami told something. Well, one might wonder why is it that he narrated this experience. With the completion of an experience, you'll realize why he narrated. Because that evening, Swami told him all this. And he felt like as if he was levitating because he had knowledge of something for which only he and Swami knew. Nobody else knew. Extremely exclusive. And nowhere in the discourse it had been told before. And he says the next day, I don't remember if it is Dasara or whatever, there was a discourse scheduled. And that entire discourse was just on this. Dilating on it and sharing it with him. So, Swami is always about inclusivity. He never makes it exclusive. Even in divinity, you know, whenever people have told Swami you're divine, Swami is always told back, no, all are divine. Just that I know it and you don't know it and I'm trying to make you aware of it. So even divinity, Swami didn't make it exclusive. Therefore, it is not surprising that when it comes to exclusive mantra, Swami says that you don't need any mantra. There is a little more discussion that goes on after this. Slightly a different theme, but definitely connected to what we're discussing. We will carry on that discussion after this little break. So don't go away anywhere, dear listeners.
Sai Bhagavan, Satya Sai Bhagavan. ईशा परमानंदा साई भगवान
सत्य साई भगवान
परम पुरुष प्रभु श्री साईनाथा
परम पुरुष प्रभु श्री साईनाथा
पुरुषोत्तमा हे पति पुरीशा प्रेमसाई भगवान
प्रेमसाई भगवान
सत्य साई भगवान
सत्य साई भगवान
सत्य साई भगवान
सत्य साई
पूर्णावतारा साई गुरुदेवा
वेलकम बैक डियर लिसनर्स एंड वी वर डिस्कसिंग अबाउट मंत्रास एंड द ब्यूटिफुल पॉइंट दैट स्वामी मेड दैट व्हेन एन अवतार कम्स to listen to him, to hear him, to understand what he says and to do it, follow his command. That itself is greater than any mantra that anyone can receive from Bhagwan. And many times, you know, you wonder, there are a lot of devotees who come and say that, oh, we did not have the opportunity to see Swami, we did not have the opportunity to be with Swami. This is not to say that the opportunity to be with Swami and see Swami is any lesser. But imagine, we have read about the story of Parikshit. You know, he also has the same kind of pain that I did not see Lord Krishna. I did not have the opportunity to live with him like my grandfather, the Pandavas and all of that. Imagine there is no way by which somebody like Parikshit or his generation people would even know exactly how Krishna was and how he, you know, what he spoke, how he sounded. But our generation is not like that. Even those people who have not literally seen Swami can see Swami still. You know exactly how he looked. You know every bit of the expression on his face. You know exactly how he sounds and you can hear his message from his own voice. Right? There is no interpretation, there is no person in between telling you that I heard this and so. I mean, that also is there if you want a second-hand perspective. That is also there, but you also have the opportunity to directly hear him, right? So in that sense, we are not as disadvantaged as those people. It's only as much as we believe. And Swami says that there is no avatar, no mantra greater than that. And in that sense, we all have 900 hours of mantras in that sense. And if we really have the Shraddha, as Swami says, we will be pouring into all of that. Going forward in the discussion, then Hislop goes on to ask, Baba's teachings carries the ring of truth and his words carry into action almost by themselves. Their authority does not even depend on whether Swami is an avatar or not. And Swami responds to that, don't doubt about the avatar as Swami. Without his reading it, any question asked of Baba is answered immediately, without any pause and in detail. So this is a very interesting exchange where Hislop is speaking about the profundity and the depth in Swami's words. And we've seen this, you know, there are a lot of people who say, I was once speaking to a very senior devotee from Australia who was saying that he was part of a conference, I think some business leaders conference or something. And one of the sessions was on ethics and, you know, creating wealth for public or something like that, something in a more virtuous philanthropic attitude. So he was saying that he ended up making a lot of quotations. You know, there are some very beautiful quotations of Swami with relation to business and with relation to politics and leadership. So he said in his speech, he had just thrown a few of those, quotes without mentioning whose it is, without mentioning Swami's name, and just put a few of those quotes. And he said after the talk during the break session, so many people came and asked me only for those quotes.
Wow.
So he said that, see, Swami's words are so powerful that when you present it even to an audience who does not know Swami, who does not have reverence to Swami, it strikes a deep chord somewhere, right? So I think Hislop's question comes from that. He says, Swami's words are so true that, you know, anybody who listens it, whether they believe in Swami or not, if they're able to accept it and practice it, they're going to see the validity of it. And it, whether they practice it or not, when they listen to it, they know that this is coming from a place of purity.
And in response to that, Swami almost seems to say that even though that holds good, there is a huge added advantage when you have conviction that Swami is the avatar.
Right.
When the same words are approached with complete faith and love, the magic that they have is at a completely different level. And in fact, Swami says, without his reading it, any question of Baba is answered immediately without any pause and in detail. And you know, when I read the statement, it just reminded me of my own personal experience just a few days back.
Mm-hmm.
When I had gone to Bangalore for a family function, I just happened to go to the ITI Samiti. This ITI Samiti is actually a samiti which was based in the former ITI company. ITI stands for Indian Telephone Industries. Okay. Located in Bangalore, they used to manufacture telephones, not cell phones, the handset telephones which had to be dialed with the numbers,
mm-hmm.
which many in the millennial generation may not know.
Right.
So those telephones they used to manufacture, and they had asked me whether when you're coming, can you just, you know, talk something to the Balvikas gurus and students over here, and I had agreed. So the day before leaving to Bangalore to my sister's house, I was sitting and thinking what I should speak about. I was preparing my talk. Then I tried to search and research about this ITI Samiti in Bangalore, because it has a very, very wonderful history. Swami had initiated it on his own, and you know, I had heard a story of how it came about. So apparently there was this person who was working in the ITI, Indian Telephone Industries, and Swami called him and said, you should start a discussion on spiritual topics, start a study circle in ITI. And he said, yes Swami, where do I begin it? Swami said, start it at your home. So he said, Swami, I would love to do it, just that I have a very small home. It can accommodate maximum 5 to 10 people. So it may not be sufficient, but I will definitely do it. Swami said, you just go ahead and do it. And this person goes and he starts taking action. And, you know, it also reinforces what Swami had said before, that take the avatar's word as the mantra. That's it. You do what you're told. Don't worry about the rest. And he just went ahead to do that. In a couple of days, he was called by the chairman of ITI, of the entire company, and he was told that he's getting a promotion, which made him very happy. And he also felt this was Swami's doing, because he'll be getting definitely a better accommodation. When the accommodation was allotted to him, he was shocked because it was an accommodation that was 2-3 levels above his pay grade. Mm-hmm. It was something big, a bungalow it was, and he was just, you know, he didn't know what to say. That is when the director called him and he said that, the chairman or director, I forget, he called him and he told him that, you know, there is a reason why you are being given this accommodation. Have you heard of Sri Sathya Sai Baba? He said, sir, I am a devotee of Swami. Oh, this person also turned out to be a devotee of Swami. He said that Swami came in my dream and said that person is being promoted. Allot to him this kind of accommodation. This is what has to be done, and therefore it's in my discretion and I am choosing to allot this. And that is how it started. And even to this day, that samiti is called Sri Sathya Sai Study Circle, because Swami initiated it as a study circle. The focus of their activities is more on Balvikas and study circle and discussion, because they feel, they are convinced that is the focus that Swami gave them. It continues even to this day. So this is the history, and with such a wonderful history, I was just thinking I should find something nice. What should I speak to them about? So I went online and began to search for anything that is available on ITI Samiti and Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. And including the story that I told you, nothing is available. Nothing I found. In fact, the ITI Samiti had a Facebook page, and on the Facebook page, their activities were delineated, but nothing about anything that connects directly to Swami's physical presence there. So I finally gave up and I thought, okay, let me start preparing my talk. Swami, what should I speak on? They said it's Balvikas children, so let me pick the keyword Balvikas. And I did a site search, you know, site:/ssbpt.info, Balvikas. And because it searches only in the Book Trust site, the first 10-15 results were all discourses. Even to this day, anybody can perform the search and see. The first discourse that came, I opened it and did a control F and went to the word Balvikas. And there Swami was saying that what is important to be remembered in Balvikas today is that only women are doing it. Why are sufficient men not getting into Balvikas? Why don't they get into Balvikas? It is very important that they do. So when I saw that, I was thinking, Swami, this is how I have landed here. Is it this the message that you want me to convey? I had my doubt, but I thought, okay, I'll just read ahead. The next couple of sentences took all my doubts away, because Swami in the next few sentences said, there is a telephone industry company in Bangalore, and I had visited there. I was like, oh my God, you know, I have searched for this everywhere, I didn't find it. And here, I think it was the 20th of November 1998, the discourse. And there Swami is saying, when I visited there, I found out from the chairman that all majority of the employees working there are women. And he said that they look to employ women because women are more sincere, hardworking and dedicated. And they are more selfless in their work. And Swami said, that is why even in Balvikas, they are the one who are mainly involved. So I want also the men to get involved. Finally, yes, this was one important aspect of the speech I delivered there, but I just wanted to show that when we ask, Swami definitely answers. But even when we don't ask, Swami is there answering. Swami is there taking care of our needs without us asking as well. It is only up to us to develop that faith, because it helps us keep calm and strong in tough situations, and it helps us remain grounded, humble and feel joy in situations that are, you know, happy and successful. So when Swami says, without his reading it, any question of Baba is asked of Baba is answered immediately without any pause and in detail, I think that is as comprehensive as you can get in explaining the wonder that our Swami is.
And the other point which occurred to me is, and I think this is in the middle of a conversation that is happening between Hislop and Swami, and I think we've said this a couple of times going through some of the answers that Swami gave. Yeah. We as individuals could not comprehend what Swami was saying there, or it appeared like it was a tangential reply, or it was not a direct response to what doubt was being raised here. This could also be what Swami is saying there. You know, any line which you take, there are many, many quotes you could take from this book itself and say that this is what Swami said, and we often do that, you know. For those of our listeners who follow us on Instagram, this is something which we often do. Just a question that somebody is asking, an answer that Swami has given. Even if you don't know that it is Hislop asking and Swami answering, the exchange is very profound, right? But there are also those answers which Swami gives as the avatar, right? All these answers are given as the avatar. But as Swami is saying here, sometimes Swami answers even questions which have not been asked. Because, you know, when you're asking in front of others, you probably don't have the time, the luxury of, expressing everything that was in your mind and putting it in words. Or you might probably be embarrassed to ask exactly what you want to ask. And, you know, but all of that gets answered in the way Swami answers. And there was one very beautiful incident which one of the senior sisters from Anantapur was once sharing. And after she had graduated from Anantapur College, she became a lecturer in another college somewhere in Karnataka, and they used to come. It was a college which was set up by a devotee of Swami, and they would come every year for Swami's darshan, and there were years when Swami would call them for a group interview also. So in the group interview, there was this one time when Swami said, if you have any questions, you can ask. So there was this one girl. I mean, these are all not typically like the Anantapur students who were, you know, born and brought up in Swami's philosophy.
Hmm.
General college students, not many of them came from families which were devoted to Swami. Students who were worried about their future, worried about, you know, their exams and that kind of things. So the teachers were usually scared when something like this happens, when Swami says, ask questions, because you don't know what questions will be posed to Swami. And, you know, this girl in that interview, she looked at Swami and said, Swami, how do we ensure that we get a good husband in life? Right? I mean, a typical worry, a practical, typical worry of a, you know, girl of that age. And Swami looked at her and Swami answered very sweetly. Swami said, if your nature is like that of Sita, you will get a husband like the nature of Rama.
Wow.
But if your nature is like Surpanaka's, then your husband will have the nature of Ravana. Right? That's all Swami said. And but this has a backstory. You know, this girl was very unfortunate that in a very young age she lost her mother. And because the children were so young, the father had to remarry again, so that somebody will be there to take care of the children. And he married a lady who was of a very, very good nature. And she took very good care of the children. But somehow this girl could not accept her as a mother and she gave that lady hell. Right? And everybody in the college knew this background on this lady. For whatever reason, you know, she would be very nasty with this person. That person would be very sweet, but, you know, the way she would behave would be so bad. And
just because she's not the biological mother.
Yeah, not the biological, but the pain of losing the mother and the you know, diffidence of accepting somebody else and all of that. And all the inner bad qualities also, you know, get channeled through that anger that you have. And when Swami said this, she exactly knew what Swami was saying. Swami was referring to the way she was behaving with that mother of hers. Right? And she came out and she knew this is what, and she changed completely. Right? Mm-hmm. Because Swami was saying that, see, if this is your nature, that is what you will be given. Right? And when Swami is saying here, I answer questions which are not asked and in detail, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes only that person can understand. Right? So whatever Swami says, the words are, I mean, there is no doubt that Swami speaks. It hits you directly into the heart. And the message is so pure, right? One thing which always you feel, you know, when you compare it, you know, Swami doesn't want us to compare his words with anybody else's, but it eventually happens. But you know how pure Swami's words are, how pure Swami's concepts and thoughts are. There is no streak of selfishness in anything that Swami says. That's how pure it is. But also the fact that Swami says, don't forget that it is the avatars, right? Don't ever forget that it is being backed by, it is being said by the avatar himself. And a very beautiful example that Swami says, that I can answer even questions which have not been asked.
Going ahead, Hislop says, an incident in Shri Krishna's life that I do not understand is that when he instructed Arjuna to conduct the women and children to safety, Arjuna failed. Why? Swami replies, Arjuna always felt that Krishna was in his heart and that gave him the strength. When he heard that Krishna had died, he felt that Krishna was gone. And as he felt this, his strength left him. But Swami, if Arjuna had Krishna in his heart, why did Krishna's death have such an effect? And Swami replies, for some 80 years, Arjuna felt Krishna was with him in his heart. The reaction of shock at the news of Krishna's death caused him to momentarily forget. It was weakness. Then he was not able to recapture the feeling of Krishna being with him. So, Swami makes two things very clear. One thing is that when you have the conviction that God is in your heart, nothing can affect you. But if there are things that happen that affect your faith of that Lord in your heart or faith in God, I think you can have two kinds of doubts. One is, both are just classifications for our understanding, but they basically are doubts only. One is doubting whether God is with me or not. Second thing is doubting the power of God. You know, doubting whether, hey, does God have the power? Both of them come to the same thing of doubting God. But doubt can come like that. So, Swami says here that when Arjuna got that doubt, and that doubt came because of a very, very, very strong episode, which is Krishna, you know, who has comfortably withstood the entire Kurukshetra war, who has taken the Narayanastra into his chest. Arjuna has seen that. who has told Arjuna to step off the chariot so that he doesn't get burnt into ashes, because the chariot has received so many missiles and astras that the moment Krishna stepped off it on the final day, it completely burst into flames. So that kind of an indestructible Krishna, when he hears that he was fallen by a arrow of a hunter who shot it into his leg, it must have been a shattering experience for Arjuna. And the impact of such a shattering experience was that his faith in Krishna, in the existence of Krishna, in his heart shook. Because of which, as the story goes, when he's conducting the women and children to safety away from, I think he's taking them away from Dwarka, because the city of Dwarka is bound to fall in the days to come. That whole entourage is attacked by common bandits and robbers and thieves. And Arjuna is not able to do anything to stop them. He's not able to remember any of the mantras that are needed to energize the weapons. So, this is the explanation that Swami gives to the question that Hislop prefaces by saying that, I really cannot understand how this happened. I personally felt that Hislop was blessed in a way that he was not physically around in 2011, because each of us who have been through that 2011 when Swami left, you know, when the Swami whom we know has just taken on heart attacks, taken on strokes, taken on mumps, taken on so many, we have seen him and we have seen him shrug it off in a moment. We have seen him, as you said, pull people off wheelchairs, off stretchers, make them walk. Such a divine being, such a magnificently holy body, when we see it capitulating like any of our bodies to what? I mean, a heart problem, a kidney problem, an organ failure problem, definitely shook all of us. So, I think we are definitely in a better position to empathize with Arjuna than probably what Hislop was at that point in time.
You know, when you're talking about having doubts and having that faith whether God has the power to do it, as Swami would say, you know, that faith or that doubt itself is in, you know, you could say three stages. And one of the first is for which Swami gave the mantra that Devudunadu. Because the first doubt is there God? The first question we ask is God there? You know, the second only is, does my existence matter to God? And probably the third one is, does God really love me? Right? Do I really matter in the scheme of things to him? What I do, does it reach him? And, you know, is there a relationship between me and God? I think when an avatar comes, he comes to establish all these three. That if today somebody asks us, do you believe in the existence of God? Of course we believe in the existence of God. I sometimes say this, you know, when you read very, very advanced Vedanta, as they say, of the 16 different types of schools of Vedanta, you know, the Shaddarshanas, of course, there are many other subsects in all of this, Advaita, Vishishta Advaita and Shuddha Advaita, you know, all those kind of things. They say many of them, when they go deeper and deeper into philosophy, they actually negate the presence of God. They become like, the presence of God does not matter in your life. And almost you'll forget that there is a God who is governing all of this, right? So when you read that, suddenly you'll know, but I know that God is there because I've seen Swami. You know, that idea comes back into you. And that is a most important thing that an avatar does to all of our lives. Establishes the faith that there is God. And that God is omnipresent, that God is always looking at you, that God is inside your heart, right? And when Swami would start speaking to a person, as students, when we had the opportunity of Swami showering his love on us, that is the time when we realized that, you know, Swami actively loves me. I don't know whether that makes sense, right? When you say that God loves, that is one thing. But when you say that God loves me, that's a different feeling altogether, right? When you say a king loves his people, and when you say my mother loves me, there's a difference in that sense that I'm saying that somebody loves me, right? So when Swami starts speaking to you, when Swami starts, you have a bandage in your leg and Swami is showing that he's concerned, that is the time when Swami establishes in our mind that he loves.
That personal God, personal connect.
And, you know, and we've seen that sometimes Swami will stop that. Sometimes you will be in pain and Swami will ignore you. Sometimes you will be in need and Swami will not be concerned about you. That is the time when we'll now question that, oh, that love is over now. That love is not there. But if you see all those devotees who stood the test of time, they have found that even when Swami is not showing his love, he loves. Even when Swami is not showing his concern, he still is concerned. Right? So those people who lost their faith are those people who, when the display of love was removed, they felt that Swami does not love me anymore. I think what Swami is telling here about Arjuna is that when Swami's presence is so strong, it is easy to believe in God. But when you've based all your faith only on the presence, physical presence of Swami or physical presence of God, and when that is removed, and your faith goes with that, right? And I think Arjuna was for a brief moment in that pain. As Swami was saying, 80 years he spent with Krishna. And so his love for God and his dependence on God and his self-confidence itself was based on that. And that for a brief period, I think he lost that power. And Swami is saying that that's the period.
It's absolutely understandable. See, 80 years is a huge time frame. In fact, when I think of my own physical association with Swami, it's possibly 20 years or so, and that itself made it so hard to accept. Why go that far, you know? Recently when, yeah, my leg was in a cast, and for just 10 days for a bad sprain, and after those 10 days the cast was removed, for almost 1.5 to 2 hours I found it difficult to walk. I have been walking all my life, yet for 10 days when I got used to walking with a cast on, when the cast is removed, I found it so difficult to just walk normally. So also, when, as you said, God comes in the physical form to shower us with these, we get used to that. And when we get used to that, it takes a brief while to get unused to that. It doesn't in any way actually mean that we have lost our faith or we have forgotten God. Nothing like that. It's just that something that you have been so used to is being taken away from you, so it takes time to get used to that, to the new reality. Also the fact, it comes from the fact that we identify ourselves with the body and mind. We are not realized souls, and that is why we get affected. And that is possibly the case with Arjuna as well. The discussion continues with Hislop asking, if Arjuna had kept the feeling and concept of Krishna in his heart, would he have retained his strength? Swami says, when he heard that Krishna had died, he lost all interest in the world. Hislop adds, the gopis were overcome with grief when Krishna departed from there. They must have had him in their hearts as well. And Swami adds, at the news of Krishna's death, a number of gopis fell lifeless from shock. Hislop asks, then their relationship was only with the form of Krishna? Swami clarifies, the gopis had both relationships. Because of their years of close companionship with Krishna, they were strongly attached to Krishna's physical presence. But they also were knowing Krishna in their hearts. They always felt he was with them, even when his worldly activity had taken him far away. Now Hislop is perplexed. Then why the terrible shock if Krishna was so firmly known in the heart? Swami again says, the gopis had no interest in the world and the body once Krishna was dead. Their only reason for placing any value on their physical existence was because Krishna was also in physical existence. Their hearts were completely pure and Krishna was their heart. The physical bond was so strong. And then Swami says, for example, you have proof that Swami is always with you. But at the same time, you wish to come to India to be near Swami, isn't it? Hislop understands and he says, it seems to me that this episode of Arjuna and the death of Krishna carries a very important lesson for us who live today. And Swami says, there is no need to take Arjuna as a model. Just realize that God is with you and in your heart at all times.
That very, very beautiful and deep exchange there. And I think one thing which comes out from this is, it's very difficult for us to look at a devotee and wonder as to why the devotee goes through that. You know, why Arjuna did this? Why a Gopika, you know, fell unconscious when she got the news? Why somebody was unconcerned? It's very difficult to say. And what Swami says is very beautiful. I think that's the essence of their devotion. Wonderful point is that, you know, they were in the physical only because they felt that even the Lord is in the physical. Otherwise, they had no interest in the physical. And, you know, Swami would sometimes speak of this as the greatest state of jnana that you reach. That when you reach nirvikalpa samadhi, Swami would say that 21 days the body lives. I think that conversation was there even in this, right? Swami says it's like you've come to a point where you don't take care of the body at all, because you've lost complete interest in that. You don't
detached.
You don't identify with that. You know, I will not go and take care of some dog, right? Because I don't believe that. I mean, that animal has got nothing to do with me. It's not my dog. It's not my pet. And
it's not me.
It's not me, or it's got nothing to, you know, benefit me in any way. So Swami says, when you really believe that you are that Atma, you do not associate yourself with the body at all, and you stop caring for it completely. And 20 days, 21 days, 15 days, as Swami said, it will drop away. And Swami is clearly saying here the Gopikas were in that state. They had no interest in the body. Only thing that was holding them to the body was this feeling that the Lord is also there. And when he leaves, they say that there's nothing more left in this physical world for us. The Lord was in their heart. It's not that he was not there, but there was nothing in the physical left for them. Very, very beautiful exchange.
And another important message, I feel, is about, again, developing that one-to-one connect. Because we hear so many inspiring stories of how Arjuna is an epitome of Sakya Bhakti, among the Navveda Bhakti, that friendship. He epitomizes that, and there are many stories that show his implicit faith in Krishna. And even with such a devotee, Swami says, don't take Arjuna as a model. Don't compare, don't contrast. You develop your own one-to-one with God. It is so beautiful, because this is a pit into which all of us fall. You know, we all think that we want to be like this person. We want to be like that person. We say that, yeah, Swami is God, but you know, you are his instrument. You are this. And we go behind so many people. And that instrument that we go behind changes from time to time. And Swami is making it clear that this will just be a distraction for you on the path. I remember very clearly there was a point in time where one student was receiving so much attention from Bhagwan physically. Swami would talk to him daily. Swami would make him deliver talks. And in fact, when one devotee was quite seriously ill, Swami materialized Vibhuti and gave it to the student and told him, you go and deliver this to that person and come. And that devotee happened to be staying in the student's hometown. Mm-hmm. And me and along with me, a lot of others might have thought the same thing, that possibly because it is his hometown only, Swami is sending it through him. So he went, delivered and came back. And I remember that evening in Trai Brindavan, Swami narrated all that this boy went through. And it was amazing. And what was most amazing is Swami said that though this is his hometown, he did not go home. His parents also didn't know that he had come to this hometown. He did this and came back. And then Swami added a statement. Swami said, even when Rama sent Hanuman to Lanka, Hanuman burnt Lanka, which Rama had not told him to do. But this boy is not like that. He didn't do anything that I didn't tell him. He did exactly what I told him and came back. So, my admiration for this person went skyrocketing high. You know, so high it went. And I remember writing a letter saying, Swami, suppose this person's name was X. I said, Swami, I want to be like X. Make me like X. Make me a devotee like X. Believe it or not, Swami never took that letter from me. How much ever I tried, I kept trying. I was wondering what is wrong in this prayer. It's such a nice prayer, such a noble prayer. Yet Swami never took it from me. So much so at the end of that summer, over, you know, the Tri sessions were a feature only during the summer. Once that got over and I had to get back to college and studies, school that time, I just tore and threw away this letter. Today when I look back, I really don't know where that person is, and it just doesn't seem to matter. And I feel what is most important is how much I have grown in my love for Swami. This is my own personal experience, but I feel in his own way, for each individual, Swami has given this message very clearly, that don't come here for anybody, or don't make anybody else your role model. How many of us have seen people whom we think are undeserving of Swami's grace actually turn out to be real life heroes? How many people whom we think are really the epitome of Swami's love and grace fall in our eyes and think, oh, this person did like, you know, all this comes because, as you rightly said, we are in no way qualified to judge who is a devotee, who is how advanced in what spiritual path, what is the motivation behind what who is doing. therefore don't focus on anybody. So much so that Swami tells Hislop, don't take even Arjuna as a role model. He says, just realize that God is within you in your heart. It's like develop your own connection with Swami. I think that is another message that comes very strongly from this conversation.
The other point where Hislop is asking, you know, where Swami says that the news of Krishna's death, a number of gopis fell lifeless from shock. And Hislop asked, does that mean that the relationship was only with the form? Swami says the gopis had both relationships because of the years of close companionship with Krishna. And I think that also is pretty reflective of most, you know, what most devotees went through. Because again, that sense of judgmentalism, you know, when you look at somebody, you say, why are you crying? Swami is not the body. Grief is always spontaneous. You know, joy and grief does not wait for reason to give sanction, right? And when something is so painful, when a grief that you've never experienced till then happens, that's what it is. You know, we know that he's not the body. The very reason why we are sitting here is because he's not the body. He's not like you and me. He's beyond the body. He's shown it enough to us. It is not that it is not known, but the body relationship also is there. The fact that, you know, he made our day, we had to see him and with that darshan, that is what you are craving for. So it is both, but I think how much relatable it is, because even today we feel both the emotions. There are some days when you're walking around in the ashram, you have to remind yourself Swami is not here physically. Because you feel he's there. I mean, there is a sense of sensing that Swami is around, if I could put it that way. But there are also days when you feel that, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah, there are days when you sit bang in the middle of Sai Kulwant Hall and there's a magnificent program in progress and you feel, oh God, what is this? And you feel tears streaming down your cheeks. Absolutely right. You feel both of them. So it is, as you said, we cannot, best not be judgmental at all. I think there's a famous quote by Mother Teresa which says that, if you judge someone, you don't have time to love them, because all thing goes in judgment. And I find so many eerie resemblances between Krishna's passing and Swami leaving the body. You know, just like those times there was Mother Kunti, the moment she heard that Krishna had left, she said Krishna, and she fell. We have had devotees who have gone through that kind of an experience. But it would be wrong to think that Kunti is possibly a greater devotee than Arjuna and the Pandavas. Arjuna and Pandavas had a different kind of experience wherein they almost wasted away. They lost their strength, they lost their will to live slowly and they left. Whereas if you take the case of Parikshit, he stayed on. I mean, he was just a child. He grew up to be a king and he was responsible for the Bhagavatam as we know it today. So too, in Swami's case, all kinds of response are there. What we have to understand that each one is responding out of love for Swami in different ways. That is the response. No one is higher or no one is lower. And most importantly, none of that is our business. Our business is to grow in our love for Swami and develop that heart-to-heart connect.
Right. I think that's probably one of the, as you were saying, dangers of being around Swami's physical presence. That you look at somebody, you want to become somebody, you want to become better than somebody, you want to become closer than somebody. And I recall one of the students had made this, and you know, in Swami's love, he would accept everything. There were times when Swami would correct. Swami would say, this is wrong, don't do it this way. But sometimes Swami would accept. I recall one of my juniors praying to Swami that Swami, when Swami asked, what do you want? He said, Swami, I want to be close to you. Swami said, fine. He said, no, Swami, I want to be closer to you than everybody else. Right? He genuinely made that prayer, you know. That's a form of ego. I mean, intellectually we can say that it's a form of ego. And Swami said, yes, Bangaru, you will be closer than anybody else. I mean, that statement can be taken in any way. You know, in the deepest spiritual sense, yes, there is no other person. It's only you and him in the final equation. And you are definitely closer than anybody else in that sense. So, from Swami's point of view, he accepted all kinds of devotion. And, you know, if he had said that I'm going to accept only perfect devotion, I think we would have packed our bags long back. There's a very beautiful story that Sanjay Sani sir, our former lecturer and currently the controller of examinations, he had narrated in front of Swami. A very beautiful short story where he says there is a juggler, right? And he goes in front of God he goes to a temple. He stands in front of the idol of the deity there, and he starts juggling with his balls because he's a juggler in a circus or something like that. So he's juggling and juggling, and the story goes that, you know, God becomes curious. You know, why is he doing this in front of me? Why is he doing this act in front of me? So God appears in front of him and says, "What are you doing?" So he says, "I'm performing the only stunt that I know." Okay. And then God says, "Don't you know that I only respond to pure devotion and I don't respond to such stunts?" And then the devotee says, "But Lord, I have only this. So I am offering you my stunt devotion, and in return I want true devotion."
Beautiful. Right? In fact, even as you were saying that whatever we offer, Swami accepts, this is precisely the story that came in my mind. I only refrained from narrating it because I wasn't sure whether it is Swami's story or whether it's a story that Sanjay Sani sir narrated. I had a feeling that possibly Swami had narrated this also. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it's a very, very revealing story. And it shows that when Swami says purity of feeling, it's not that we offer only the pure feeling. With a pure intention and with pure love, anything that we offer, you know, that itself is purity of feeling. It doesn't mean I have to be a perfected individual to offer anything, but with a heart full of love, anything that I offer becomes perfect. And like that stunt juggler, may we also pray to Swami that, "Swami, we offer our love to you in so many ways. It's all," as Swami would say, I remember the way he would say, "Stunt, Ra, the stunt. This is all stunt." Yes, Swami, being so much attached to our bodies and being so egoistic, most of the things we do are only stunts, Swami. But we know that you have such love for us that you will accept our stunt devotion and confer on us true devotion. Ever grateful to you for that. And with that, we will conclude today's episode of Afternoon Satsang. We will continue where we left off from the next week. Until then, the listeners, enjoy this song. Any feedback, anything that you want to share with us, you can do so by writing to us at listener@radiosai.org. So we'll now leave you with the song, on the other side of which, as always, you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
Anyatha Sharanam Nasti Twameva Sharanam Mama. Tasmat Karunya Bhave Raksha Raksha Saishwara Saishwara. Bhagavan, he prema maya Bhagavan, ananda maya Bhagavan, he prema maya Bhagavan, ananda maya Bhagavan, he prema maya Bhagavan, ananda maya Bhagavan, he prema maya Bhagavan. O Bhagavan, Sai Bhagavan.
ప్రేమమయ భగవాన్.